this particular message, as we walk through Acts 27, and that's where we are today, is one of those messages that I don't want to be emotional, but it is going to require that we be willing to maybe get in touch with some of our emotions, which for some of us is no problem. For others, that's a daunting, fearful endeavor. And so I want to pray towards that end. And we're going to be touching on some things, I think, today. My prayer is that we do, that maybe we've sort of pushed down, aren't willing to talk about right now. We're just wanting to get through the next little while so we can go watch the game or games. And I want to just to slow down and just go, God, just as we sang the last song leading into this, God, we want to hear from you, and I pray that you would give us the courage to do so. So that's what I want to pray for. So would you join me in prayer? Father, I do pray for that. I pray that hearing from you and our desire to do so would not be just a song we sing, but it would in fact be a cry from our hearts that we are listening, want to listen. Help us therefore listen to you. I pray that we would have courage maybe to delve into those places in our lives that need to be delved into. Your word promises to divide, getting into the very essence of who we are. Not the who that we show the world, but the who, in fact, that you see in the who that needs to be invaded by your grace, by your spirit. And so I pray that that would happen today for your name's sake. Amen. We love metaphors. We use metaphors all the time. In fact, we use metaphors so frequently that we don't even realize that we're using them. We say things like, that exam was a breeze. We talk about things like life being a roller coaster, their kid's a little demon, right? Which is a mean thing to say, but we do say that, or at least we think it. We say things like her relationship's a prison. We say things like love is a crocodile in a river of desire, right? We say that all the time. We use metaphors all the time. That's my point. We throw them out there without even thinking about them. In theological circles, God is oftentimes referred to in metaphorical language. He is a strong tower. He is a good shepherd. He is the bread of life. In today's text, Acts chapter 17, we are going to join Paul on a voyage towards Rome. Finally, we're going to get to Rome. It's a literal voyage that is fraught. Great word, fraught, filled with tension and intrigue and calamity. But it's also a voyage that I believe serves as a metaphor for life and faith. It's a voyage that travels through some incredible stormy times and ends with a shipwreck. And there are few metaphors that we use in connection with life and faith than ones like storm and shipwreck. I mean, we ask questions. How are things going? Stormy. How's your relationship with what's her name? It's taken on water, right? It's taken on water. How's your marriage? Capsizing. How's your career? It's on the rocks. How are you feeling right now? Shipwrecked. In fact, Paul himself uses this type of metaphor language to describe in 1 Timothy 1, those who have made shipwreck of their faith. Now, what I'm going to suggest to you as we get into Acts 27 is that it is a living parable. In other words, if the parable of the prodigal son, for example, is a parable in word, then what we have here in Acts 27 is a parable in flesh and blood. If a parable is an earthly story with heavenly meaning, then what Acts 27 is an earthly story, an earthly event with spiritual truth and hope and warning and redemption weaved all the way through it. Now, there are a number of ways that we could walk through Acts 27. It's 44 verses long. It's a big text. And so the one that I am taking this morning is having it answer the question, what are we to do when we find ourselves living in the midst of the storms that we create? I chose this approach this morning because many of us, to various degrees, are living in stormy times right now. Some of us are experiencing F5 type storms that are pounding our marriages or our jobs or our kids, and it's all we can do just to hold on. Some of us are open and honest and are involved with others as we walk through our storms. We talk about our storms. And then there are some of us who work very hard at internalizing our storms, keeping them inside, but knowing very well that as hard as we may try at that, they erupt at times, affecting our relationships, showing up and bringing levels of calamity into our relationships, again, with our spouses or our kids or our boss or our employees or ourselves, for that matter. Some of us have perhaps even come to places where we've just given in to the storm and are feeling quite literally shipwrecked. Our life, our faith, our relationships, our soul, absolutely battered. So let's set the stage, show you what I mean, and see if, again, God would answer our prayers to be courageous as we may hit upon some things that, for some of us, are really scary things to hit upon. Let me begin things by reading verses 1 to 12 in Acts 27. It begins this way, "And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramidium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lasea. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, 'Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there.'" Again, as I said on the front end, the question that's going to guide us through this text is the question, what do we do when living in the midst of the storms we create? Well, the first something we can do is something that we can do before the full impact of the storm arrives. What is that something? Well, it's we aren't to ignore the pre-storm warning signs. In other words, instead of choosing to enter the storm, notice the warning signs starting to blow around us. In these 12 verses, verses 1 to 3 actually depict a pretty smooth start, right? Verses 1 to 3 are great. What we read in verses 1 to 3 is Paul and some other prisoners are put on a boat under the oversight of a Roman centurion named Julius. This is sort of like Con Air. Remember the movie Con Air? This is like Con Water, all right? So you don't have Nicolas Cage and John Cusack. You got Julius and Paul, bunch of cons, so to speak, prisoners put on a ship and they're being taken to Italy, specifically to Rome. And again, things at the very beginning are kind of peachy, right? We read about them dropping in on some ports. We read about friends that have joined Paul, some of his buddies, Aristarchus. We read that Luke is with them because he writes in plural language. So Luke and Aristarchus are with Paul. Paul is also finding some favor with Julius, for he lets Paul drop in on some buddies along the way. So it's smooth sailing in verses 1 to 3. Starts out kind of nice. But in verse 4, if you put your faces down, eyes down into verse 4, we get the first tinge that trouble lurks. In verse 4, we read that the winds were against us. And you get to verse 7, things ramp up from verse 4 when we read in verse 7 that the wind did not allow us to go. And by verse 9, we read that the voyage was now dangerous. And by the time we get to verse 10, things have moved to a place where Paul perceived that the trip, if it carried on any further, was going to end. And you can see it there with injury and much loss, but they chose to ignore the warning signs. And oftentimes so too do we. In fact, some of us right now may not exactly be living in category 5 winds of our lives, but there's enough blowing around us to suggest that a big storm's coming. But we're choosing to ignore the signs, carry on with the hope that things will just kind of blow over. For others of us, we've moved from verse 4 to verse 7, right? Where things are getting a little more difficult, resistance is happening, and for others still, we're living in the midst of absolute danger. We are in danger mode with injury and much loss staring us face to face, but we keep on ignoring all of it, and we voyage on. We do this in all facets of life, by the way, but perhaps the most obvious examples of this comes in our relationships, right? I don't mean to pick on engaged couples, but I'm going to pick on engaged couples. That's why we do marriage preps, why it's starting up again today. See, in our relationships, you know how it goes. We meet someone great, right? They got dimples, cuties, like the same music. They have a nice car. And everything starts out hunky-dory, but you soon discover that even though he said he is a Christian, he doesn't show much faith and or much interest in faith discussion and spiritual practices, but you choose to ignore it and give it more time. But after several months, his spiritual disinterest is more telling, even telling to the point where you have friends speaking into your life, but you choose to ignore your friends because they don't know him like you know him. Lightning, right? Storm, windy. But we keep on pressing on. And all of a sudden, one day, you wake up, and it's been 2 years since you've been dating this guy. And so you might as well start talking about marriage because you have so much invested into the relationship anyways. And besides, marriage will change him. Won't it? Oh, you bet it will. You hear the wind. You see the waves. And before you know it, you're saying, I do. Marrying a man who shows no passion for Jesus, the Bible, prayer, service, but you ignore all of it and enter a marriage that stands a great chance of shipwrecking. I think what we see here in verses 1 to 12 is we can't ignore the warning signs of storms that are coming. Here's the second thing that we are to do. We need to be willing to listen to godly advice. Another way to put this, because that may sound very churchy to you, let me put it in these terms. Be willing to listen to advice that goes against culture or is countercultural. See, we read, if you put your eyes again down in your text, we read that in addition to ignoring the warning signs, the crew, Julius in particular, because he's overseeing this, ignores the premonition of Paul in verse 10 and instead pays more attention to the pilot and the owner of the ship in verse 11. Now, there is some obvious wisdom in garnering the insight of those who have more experience in certain things. However, couldn't there just take the chance of considering this? Couldn't there at least be a chance that an owner and a pilot of a ship, a captain of a ship carrying cargo in verse 10, you see it there, needing transport so as to receive payment on the other end may have some ulterior motives behind their advice? Doesn't the but that begins verse 11 sort of stand out ominously? Paul said this in verse 10, but Julius considered the advice of the pilot and the owner instead. Julius was journeying further into a storm, and he chose to listen only to those who are more likely not looking out for his best, which begs the question, who do you listen to? It's a question you're going to unpack further in your community groups. And the question is really packed in with the idea, at least a suggestion, of allowing yourself, ourselves, the opportunities to hear from those who may bring a different perspective, a spiritual perspective, a godly perspective. See, we need to have people that are willing to speak into our lives without fear of losing anything. And I'm not necessarily saying that they have nothing to lose. What I'm saying is that they don't have fear of losing it. See, there's a lot of people that will speak into our lives, but they fear losing something, so they hold back. And they give you what you want to hear. Some of those who are closest to us don't give us good advice because they're fearful of losing something. We need to have people in our lives that have the type of faith and believe and are so assured of who they are that they can speak into our lives without fear of losing something they have now. In the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 24, verses 5 and 6, the wise man is full of strength, we read, and a man of knowledge enhances his might, for by wise guidance, and that qualifier of guidance is really important, by wise guidance, you can wage your war, and in abundance of counselors, there is victory. But worse than simply listening to too narrow a group, Julius listening just to the pilot and the captain, or the owner of the ship, excuse me, we read in verse 12 that not only did this crew ignore the warning signs, number one, right, the storm that's brewing, not only did they not listen to godly advice, but they let the majority decide, we read in verse 12, setting out on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix. And there's something about that phrase, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix. A lot of us live our lives on the chance that somehow we'll reach our Phoenix. Literally Phoenix for some of us, right? If I just work hard, I'll reach Phoenix for the last 20 years. And just, anyways, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix. See, allowing the majority to decide our decisions is very true in our culture as well. See, even those, and this is ironic, I think, it's telling if you just step back and you take a look at the culture just of Vancouver itself. Even those in our city whose greatest aim is to fight the majority and display their individuality and nonconformity, they move to places in our city where other individualists and nonconformists live. It's called commercial, right? I mean, it's called Main Street. I mean, it's we do this, right? It's sort of this weird idea of nonconformists unite, right? So you see sign, like the anarchist meeting is at Thursday at 8 o'clock. Don't be late. He's like, wow, that's ironic. I mean, how do anarchists organize themselves? All right, it's greatly ironic. See, what we need at times in our lives certainly is we need more uncommon advice. Not just live by common sense, but uncommon sense. You want to be a nonconformist or counter to the culture in this city? Walk with Jesus. See, in this city, getting tatted up and sleeping with anyone doesn't make you a nonconformist. It makes you the rule. A part of the mass. One of the mass. Here's the third thing to do. Don't allow calm days to be the validator of your decisions. Take a look at verse 13. They head out, right? Verse 12. Hey, what's the majority doing? What's everybody say? What should we do? Let's listen to the pilot. Let's listen to the owner. Let's not take a look at the warning signs. Let's certainly not listen to that guy. So they set out. Look at verse 13. Now when the south wind blew gently. Oh, that's nice. Supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. In other words, we're good. We're going to make it. This is fabulous. The weather has turned. This is nice. We're smooth sailing. The wind is helping us. Everything's going to be great. Just look around. And don't we do this at times? Don't we allow experience to trump wisdom? Don't we allow smooth days to really stand as the validator in spite of what we see around us? I probably shouldn't give myself to this, but I've never been so happy and felt so valued and alive. But when we evaluate our decisions solely on the grounds of easy breeziness, what do we use to evaluate when easy breeziness isn't being experienced? See, when easy breeziness and calm days are your evaluation tool, then when those days aren't happening, then your only conclusion has to be, not could be, has to be, I was wrong, I got to get out of this. I got to leave this. Calm and happy days can be deceptive. For weather can change abruptly, can't it? Take a look at verse 14. Let's read through verse 20. But soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it. We're driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Kata, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard and with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Man, this is some of us right now. We ignored the warning signs. We disregarded those people that stood against the majority that wanted to speak into our lives. We allowed the odd calm day to dupe us into further journey. And now we find ourselves in a place where, like verse 18, where violently storm-tossed is a pretty apt way of describing how we're doing right now. See, what takes place in verse 15, if you look at verse 15, often does when we find ourselves living in the tempestuousness that is now our lives, we give way to it, to be driven along. Westside, do you know what this is? This is a life resigned. I can't change. They're not going to change. My situation isn't going to change. I mean, in light of the things I've done or I've done to others, or others have done to me. Come on, this is my life. This is my life. Yes, I should have said no back there, but doggone it, I didn't. And this is my life here, and nothing's going to change. This is always going to be me. It's a life resigned. Some of you have been living in 20 years of resignation because of a decision you made back there. And the last 20 years has been a combination of violently storm-tossed or self-medication. And what happens in those moments of resignation is that it leads to verse 20, a verse 20 type of despair. See, a life resigned gives way to a verse 20 type despair. Lives lived with all hope of being saved, abandoned. Some of us are living in verse 20 right now. You've given up on your marriage. You've given up on ever conquering that besetting sin. You've given up on any chance of reconciliation to that person, whoever that person is. Is there forgiveness? Is there redemption? Is there hope? Or is this it? And if it is, then leave me alone to self-medicate. Put on my mask, for I have no desire for people to know who I really am. And quite frankly, I don't really know if I know who I really am anymore. Living in verse 20 type despair is a frightening place to be, is it not? But it can also be a place that moves us to finally listen to voices that we have been ignoring, choosing not to listen to all along. See, the beauty of Acts 27 in this storm is that in this time where all hope is abandoned, grace invades the story. And don't you want the grace to invade the story? I mean, don't you want grace to invade your story? Some of us need to be invaded by grace. Because we've been living in this resignation for so long now. And the truth is that oftentimes we need to experience desperate times before we're willing to be invaded by grace. Do you know what I mean? Oh, Westsiders, I hope you know what I mean. Yeah. Hey, thank you, brother. Look at that guy. Dad's here. All right. Sorry. I haven't spoken much recently and I'm fired up. There's a storm. There's a storm in the Gospels that we've gone to a number of times over the years. I'm not going to take you to the text, although you will unpack it in your community groups this week. But it's a storm. It's actually a voyage that leads to a storm. It's a voyage that begins very much like the one we're walking through here in Acts 27. The storm that I'm talking about is a storm that's recorded for us in a couple of places, but in Mark chapter 4, it's where Jesus, along with the disciples, get into a ship, a boat to be more exact, and they head to the other side. Jesus says, let's go to the other side. And it starts very tranquil, very smooth, to the point where Jesus, he crashes. He's tired. He's sleeping on a cushion. But quickly thereafter, a storm erupts. The winds come up to the point that it leads these disciples, some of them that are experts in fishing, it leads them to a time of desperation to the point where they think they are going to die. And they finally wake Jesus up and they cry out in fear of Jesus to Jesus. Jesus, don't you care if we're going to die? And Westsides, that's what storms do. They cause us to ask questions that calm times rarely do. God, don't you care? Don't you care? Storms cause us to ask questions like, who is this man that can command the waves and the wind? Storms also cause us to recognize that Jesus enters our storms. He wants to journey with us to the other side. And that he's our peace in the midst of storms. He invades our storms, actually taking our place in the ultimate of storms. See, Westside, there is grace in storms. It is interesting that the word translated wind in chapter 27 of the book of Acts is also translated at times the Spirit of God. And is it not true, Westside, that one person's storm can so often be that person's work of the Spirit too? Grace invades the story, and with it, we begin to see a way out. Let me show you what I mean by reading verses 21 to 26. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart. For there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, man, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island." When we find ourselves having lost all hope, in the midst of the storms, we create, what is Paul's counsel out from there? When we come to the place in our lives, in the midst of the storm, that we're willing to listen to counsel from those that we've been pushing aside, pushing away from us, hiding from us, what is the way out when we turn to those and hear from those? Well, one of the first things that Paul gives us is that we need to own our sin. See, when Paul says to the crew in verse 21 that they should have listened to him, it wasn't sort of this, "Oh, I told you so. You guys should have listened to me." It wasn't one of those moments. What it was a, "You need to own this one instead." See, the issue, and this is what is so, I think, applicable to us. The issue in this event is not the unfairness of the storm. The issue was their unwillingness to listen on the front end. Your cantankerous wife didn't make you cheat. You did. Your boss didn't make you do unethical deal after unethical deal. You did. Your loneliness didn't make you get into bad relationship after bad relationship. You did. Your singleness and libido didn't make you sit in front of the computer all night. You did. See, we need to own this. We disregard, don't listen, don't take heed of warning signs. We get in the midst of something, a storm erupts, and you know what we oftentimes do? We blame God for the storm. Knowing that if it wasn't for the storm, we wouldn't even consider walking back. If it wasn't for the grace of the storm, we wouldn't open ourselves to listening to those that God has given us. See, we need to own these things. We need to confess these things. We need to admit these things. We need to say, yes, it was my unwillingness to listen and serve my needs and desires first and foremost and instead that led me to this. And Paul says, guys, you needed to listen to me. You need to own this. You need to take some ownership of this plight. But in addition to that, Paul doesn't end there. In addition to that of owning our sin, we need to receive the promises of God. See, not just know them or hear them. Hear me on that. Not just know them or hear them, but receive them, live them, taste them, marinate in them, allow them to change your lives. Paul said to the crew, if you take a look at verses 22 to 24, take heart, our lives will not be lost. There is not a life that will be lost. An angel of the Lord assured me of this, and there are so many promises of God that have been given to us that are so applicable to those storm-ridden periods of our life that we live through. Promises of forgiveness and cleansing and redemption and hope and strength and grace and calling. All ours if we would receive them. But here's what I know. I know when we're living in times of desperation, it's hard to receive, believe, and hold on to the promises of God, isn't it? I mean, it's tough. Like, I hear what you're saying, Funk, about forgiveness and redemption and strength and grace and all of that and God's care, but it's hard for me. I want to believe them, but it's hard for me. I want to receive them, but I can't. I feel so absolutely desperately weak. And you know what's great about this story is it gets that. Because the promises, just note it. Notice the promise the angel gave Paul in verse 24. Paul, you will go to Rome, as will all those with you. Paul says, look, I have faith in this. Stick with me. See, this is vital for us to get, for there are those times where we will find ourselves in places of desperation. And even though we hear the promises of God and want to live in them, we can't, for we feel so weak. And therefore, it's in those times, especially when we need to journey with others and allow their faith in a very real sense to be our faith too. Do you know what I mean? Those who will pray when we can't. You ever been there? You got to go somewhere and you're like, man, I can't even pray. I don't know what to say. And the promise of God is that, yes, the Spirit prays on our behalf. But there are times, too, in addition to that, to allow the body of Christ and not just the Spirit of Christ to be gathered around us, where we're just in the presence of people who will pray when we can't, that we're in the presence of those people who will walk when we can't even put a foot in front of ours, that there will be people whose courage becomes our courage because we feel too weak. Paul said, stick with me and you'll be okay. See, we need to be those people at times, and at times we need those people. What we never need is isolation. If we are strong, then help the weak. If we are weak, latch on to someone strong. I mean, Paul himself, and you can read this on the screen in 1 Thessalonians 5. He says, we urge you, brothers. It's inclusive language there. Sisters, encourage the faint-hearted. Help the weak. Be patient with them all. See, the great thing about the kingdom of God, it's a kingdom full of the lowest common denominator. You know what I mean? It's a little weak and faint-hearted people. And there are times we feel strong. So we come along those. Then there's times where we feel weak and we go, man, I need you. Where you just show up to your community group and you sip tea and sit in the back. Sit in the bathroom for all I care. Just be around people. You know what I mean? Just be there. Where you just receive and allow their faith to carry you on your voyage. I need to read to the end of the text. Let's pick things up in verse 27. When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, so they were taking a lifeboat, so to speak. Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. It's a really important verse. It's a telling verse. It's the number one reason why I believe this chapter serves as a metaphor for us. For it doesn't make sense outside of that. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ships and let it go. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, I guess, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. There's a truth nugget in there. I don't have time to unpack, but there's a truth nugget in there. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons on the ship, and there's been volumes written on that number. I'll let you have fun with it by yourselves. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Now, when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run a ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then, hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made it for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow struck, remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to the land. I want to close by just pointing out one final thing to do when living in the storms that we create, especially when we've come to the point of desperation where we're wanting to be led out. And that is, we need to remember that the promises of God that are given to us will be tested. What do I mean by that? Why do I make this the last point? Well, remember the promises of God given to Paul and shared with the crew, right? In verses 21 to 26, we're all going to get there. We're all going to get there, and we're going to run aground on some island. Well, take a look at the testing that this proved to be for the crew. For example, Paul says in verse 26, we need to run aground, but running aground was what they feared most. You see that in verses 17 and 29. They, in fact, pray in verse 29 that they wouldn't. They were fearful of it. It's funny what we pray for, isn't it, in light of God's promises? Paul said, we will all be okay. Some, however, wanted to grab a lifeboat and save themselves instead. See, Westside, the journey out of our storms will, along the way, test our faith in the promises of God. And oftentimes, we won't arrive at a place of peace and safety until that which took us into the storm in the first place is broken up and destroyed. What do we do when we find ourselves in the midst of storms that we create? Well, don't ignore the pre-storm warning signs. Listen to some uncommon sense. Beware of calm days. Own our sin. Receive the promises of God. And if you are too weak to receive them, then put yourself in the proximity of those whose faith can be yours. And finally, remember that you will be tested along the way. I want to close by just asking some questions that will lead us into a time of response. Anybody feeling resigned today? Anybody living a life resigned? Anyone feeling hopeless? Shipwrecked, even? Anyone needing to own anything? Anyone have anything that needs to be destroyed? Because it's keeping you from safe harbor? Anyone feeling alone, weak, and faint-hearted? If that is in part or perhaps in the whole hell you're feeling, then can I offer you Jesus? Who is sovereign over all storms? Who doesn't just send us into storms or allow us to journey into them, but he enters them with us? Can I offer you Jesus? Can I offer you Jesus in such a way that perhaps he's the question that you've been yelling out to someone somewhere? God, do you care? Can I offer you Jesus as the one who takes your place in your storm? Would you rise as we respond, please, Westside?